Into the Fold is a podcast on mental health issues produced by the Hauck Foundation for Mental Health. The Hauck Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. Hi, welcome to Into the Fold, a podcast on mental health issues. I am your host, Ike Evans, and today we are talking about a new book, The Angel and the Assassin, The Tiny Brain Cell That Changed the Course of Medicine.
In 2012, a discovery occurred in a young researcher's lab at Harvard, which changed everything.
That was Donna Jackson Nakazawa, the author of The Angel and the Assassin. She'll be joining us shortly to talk about her book and its implications for mental health. But first, I wanted to unpack the angel-assassin metaphor that Donna so effectively uses in building her case. The angel and the assassin refers to microglial cells, tiny cells in the brain that were once thought to play a minor role in brain development and functioning, at least compared to other kinds of brain cells, but are now understood to play a key role in a variety of brain disorders, including Alzheimer's, autism, and perhaps even mental health conditions such as depression, anxiety, OCD, and schizophrenia. Researchers were able to piece this out by first noticing and then studying the ways that microglial cells seem to play a role analogous to that of the immune cells in the rest of our bodies. So now we need to take a step back and remember a central fact about the human immune system. It is ruthless, effective, and our health depends on that ruthless effectiveness working for rather than against us. Immune cells respond to a complex suite of genetic and chemical signals that tell them when to react, how strongly to react, and what to react to. Any disruption in this signaling can turn our immune cells from the angels that they normally are to the assassins responsible for autoimmune diseases such as lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, or even Guillain-Barré syndrome, which Donna Jackson Nakazawa herself once experienced and recounts in her book. But before getting any further carried away with our metaphor, I'd like to give a quick plug to the book that we're going to be talking about. It has received generous amounts of critical praise, including this bit of praise from Peggy Orenstein, notable best-selling author herself. The Angel and the Assassin is one of those astonishing medical yarns you almost can't believe. How the power of this tiny cell was so long overlooked, how integral it has become to our understanding of neuroscience and immunology, how it has transformed the most basic idea of who we are as humans. And I concur, it's quite an enjoyable read. For those listening, I urge you to listen all the way to the end of the episode because I will provide you with details on how you can obtain a free copy of the book of your very own. Without further ado, let's now turn to our guest, Donna Jackson Nakazawa, author of The Angel and the Assassin, The Tiny Brain Cell That Changed the Course of Medicine. She is an award-winning science journalist and the author of three previous books exploring the intersection of neuroscience, immunology, and emotion. In fact, one of those previous books, Childhood Disrupted, was featured right here on the podcast. I'll be saying more about that later in our episode, but first, Donna, it's so great to have you back.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So I mentioned in my intro your past experience with Guillain-Barré syndrome, but I'd really like you to take it from there. In particular, how did that whole experience lead you hot on the trail of the microglial cells that you talk about in your book?
Well, so I was paralyzed twice and in and out of the hospital three or four times between 2001 and 2005 with recurring episodes of an autoimmune disease called Guillain-Barré, which, as in all autoimmune diseases, our immune system is trying to help us fight something off. In my case, this happened every time I got the stomach flu. But our immune system can go too far and, in trying to do its good job, start to make mistakes in what we call friendly fire. And in my case, my immune system, my white blood cells, were going so far that they were destroying the myelin, that protective coating around my nerves, and that caused all of my nerve muscle connections to go dark. I couldn't walk. I was paralyzed. I had trouble swallowing. I couldn't use my arms. And as I began to recover, I started to experience some cognitive changes as well. I had never experienced depression. I began to feel a kind of darkness in my brain that at the time, because Harry Potter was very popular then, and I was reading it to my kids from bed, where I was bedridden, those dementors, you know, that J.K. Rowling writes about, that come and just completely change your mood state and take away all of your joy. I felt like the dementors had taken over my brain. I just felt a darkness, a bleakness, a dread I couldn't shake. And on top of that, I had some cognitive changes. I would forget words. I would forget how to do simple kitchen table math with my kids. And I began asking my doctors, what's going on here? I know I have this very physical and serious autoimmune disease. And even as I'm recovering, I'm finding that my brain is a little different. And at that time, the understanding in the medical world across medicine, psychiatry, neurology, was that the brain and body were church and state entities. Actually, for 300 years since the era of Descartes, the philosopher who put forth the idea of mind-body dualism, it had been held sacrosanct in medicine and psychiatry that the brain was immune privileged. In other words, our immune system rules every organ in our body except our brain. And in fact, there were good anatomical reasons for believing this as well. It wasn't just, 300-year-old philosophy. Early anatomists had found that an area at the base of the brain called the blood-brain barrier contained a pack of cells so tightly packed that immune molecules didn't have the ability to travel through them. Think of them almost like a funnel. So immune molecules didn't have the capacity to travel up through this very tight funnel at the base of the brain and oversee brain health. And the third factor here was that the brain has this thing called the skull. So when we think of immune modulated inflammation in the body, so let's say you're hanging a picture and you hit your thumb by mistake with a hammer, your thumb gets red hot, painful, swollen. Yeah. That's the definition of inflammation. But A, there are no immune cells, the immune molecules can't travel up to the brain. Two, we have this skull. So obviously we can't have inflammation in the brain because the brain can't get red hot, painful, and swollen. Because it has this skull, it has nowhere to go. Now, there's a caveat there in severe traumatic injuries. It's in a car crash. The brain does swell and you have to go relieve pressure. But all of these different factors led there to be a universal categorical agreement taught in every medical school textbook, taught in psychiatric school, med school curriculums, that the brain was categorically immune privileged.
Yeah.
So my doctor said to me, well, of course you're depressed. You know, you've been paralyzed a couple of times and you're struggling to learn to walk again, and that's depressing. And I understood that, but I felt as a science reporter that something else was afoot. And I began keeping a file and looking at these correlations in the literature and began to see around 2009, 2010, 2011, a pivot in the literature epidemiologically, beginning to look at this curious link between patients with lupus, who were many times more likely to experience not just depression, but bipolar, psychosis, cognitive decline, patients with MS, curious cases in the literature of a patient with schizophrenia who received a bone marrow transplant, which would mean healthy new white blood cells, healthy new immune cells, and his schizophrenia went away. In another case, two brothers, one donated his bone, who had schizophrenia, donated his bone marrow to his brother, and his brother developed schizophrenia. So we began to see tons of things like this. Alzheimer's and gum disease were correlated. Well, obviously, if there's no brain-body connection, if the brain is the only organ in the body not ruled by the immune system, this body of epidemiological research didn't fit. It didn't make sense. And then in 2012, a discovery occurred in a young researcher's lab at Harvard, which changed everything.
So I guess the real star of our story is microglia. How did all of science miss the true role of this tiny cell for so long?
Well, great question. And so, you know, coming from these two fields, the philosophy of medicine and anatomy of medicine, you have wide agreement that the brain doesn't have an immune system. It's not ruled by the body's immune system. So that began to change when, in 2012, a researcher, Beth Stevens at Harvard, began to look at these little microglial cells more closely. Now, they had first been noted and named in the brain by early neuroscientists, actually Spanish neuroscientists, in the 1920s. They were noted and named as part of a group of what were called glial cells, and those included three other types of glial cells, all of which seemed to have fairly boring jobs in the brain. They were four types of cells that I think of and I describe them as kind of like the entourage that hangs around a movie star. And the movie star would be neurons. Neurons mm-hmm. are the flashy darlings of the research world, and they have been for a century. So microglia were thought to be one of these four types of helper cells, the tiniest of these four types of entourage helper cells, which help neurons. And the least important, they were thought to have the most boring job in the human body. Their job was to take a dead neuron, behave like a robot, and cart it away. So neuroscientists noted them, named them, and forgot about them. And for the nearly 100 years, 98 years, researchers largely ignored them. So we missed it in the way we missed germ theory. We made an assumption that with germ theory, of course, that, you know, if you were sick and you coughed into your hand and then shook somebody else's hand, that one organism, human organism, could not pass germs on to another. Sometimes in science, something is so categorically assumed and taught from one set of students, you know, professors to students to the next generation, that no one really questions it. And so that is what makes it so wild that when this one researcher began to look at it more closely, what she found was so astonishing that it rewrites our entire understanding of the human brain.
So in a nutshell, what is it that these cells do? And could you explain how it is that they can go from angels to assassins, per your title?
Great question. So the reason I titled the book The Angel and the Assassin is because these cells, which were thought to be boring janitors, turn out to have two capabilities, and both are more powerful than we had ever anticipated. So What happened in 2012 is that, and actually the research was going on in 2011, is that a young researcher who just was starting her own lab at Harvard was really interested in these cells. Some pictures had been emerging of these cells with new tools that allow for much higher resolution images of the brain around that time. And she had been looking at some of these images done by other colleagues, and she saw that these cells were there were a lot of them in the brain, more than we thought, up to 10% of the brain cells or of our brain cells are made up of microglial cells. And they were moving very quickly to what appeared to be the site of any problem in the brain. So she began a series of experiments to see what they were actually doing. And she and her postdoc, Dori Schaefer, who's now at the University of Massachusetts, they devised a way to look at the brain using high-resolution tools and staining microglial cells, one color, and synapses in the brain, another color. Now, to back up, synapses in the brain are the firing and wiring that's done by neurons, which help our brain, different areas of the brain, to communicate with each other, you know, important areas of the brain so that we can think. And this determines our mood and our responses to the world around us and how alert we are, our cognitive capabilities. So all of the different things that make up our mood states and our clarity of mind and our responses and perceptions and interpretations and memories come down to these synaptic connections in the brain. And what Beth and Dori saw was that microglia, when they were agitated, began eating synapses in the brain. And this was a mind-boggling discovery. Meanwhile, at Mount Sinai in New York, School of Medicine, they found that microglial cells actually are immune cells. On the ninth day of gestation in human development, these little microglial cells break off from the body's immune cells, from white blood cells, and they travel up to the brain where they reside throughout a human being's lifetime. So we don't have white blood cells in the brain. We don't need them. Their cousins, microglia, are already policing the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And what Beth found was that when these microglial cells are triggered, they morph like big Pac-Men into big destroyers, and they begin chomping and destroying healthy brain synapses, as well as spitting out inflammation in the same way that when immune cells in the body get revved up, they can attack tissue and organs. It's pretty mind-boggling. It rewrites our entire understanding of the brain. And as if all that were enough, in 2015, a researcher, Yoni Kipnis at UVA, discovered something that all earlier anatomists and neuroscientists and neurobiologists had missed. He found that our lymphatic vessels, which run by like this underground water system through our body, ferrying immune cells and lymphatic cells all through the body as part of our immune system, it had been categorically accepted that there were no lymphatic vessels connecting to the brain, that our lymphatic vessels stopped with that blood-brain barrier. Mm-hmm. But Yoni found them actually layered through the meningeal spaces which surround and connect to the brain, which means that now we have several different ways in which immune cells in the body are talking to immune cells in the brain. Immune cells in the brain called microglia. And that is, immune cells in the body are cousins to the white blood cells of the brain, microglia. So they both respond to the world around us, whether we're talking about emotional stressors, toxins, past infections, current infections, physical traumas. They're both our immune cells in the body, white blood cells, and our white blood cells of the brain, microglia, are in this intricate dance with our environment 24/7. If something is threatening or worrisome or stirs up inflammation because our body has to make a fight-flight response and decide how much danger we're in, or if our body has to decide, how am I going to fight this incoming pathogen? Our immune cells from the top of our head to the tip of our toes are responding. And if they respond too vigilantly, they can go into overdrive. If they go into overdrive in the body, they can begin to harm tissue and organs, as in my case with Guillain-Barré, where my immune system mistakenly began to demyelinate my nerves. And in the brain, they can make a mistake of spitting out neuroinflammatory toxins and destroying synapses. And now we also know, thanks to Yoni Kipnis at UVA, that these lymphatic vessels are also carrying messages up from the body's white blood cells, T cells, macrophages, all these different types of immune cells, right to the brain and giving messages to microglia. So we are one immune organ from head to toe, responding in this 24/7 gene environment dance. And our immune system in the brain is like our seventh sense. You know, we have our five senses, plus we have a sixth sense of proprioception, you know, where we are in time and space. But we also have this seventh sense, this constantly responsive set of immune cells in the brain, which are saying, are we in danger here? Is there something coming? Is this, an ongoing stressor that I'm facing? Is it dangerous to me? Is there something happening down there in the body? Do we have some infection going that I need to get busy and start to worry about? And those messages from the environment and between body and brain can trigger microglia to go too far and take out the synapses we need to think clearly, have a mood state that's, you know, joyful and able to handle all that's coming to us in our life, you know, the many stressors. And these are the same synaptic connections that we see in depression, bipolar, Alzheimer's, many other disorders, OCD, you name it, we see it in this loss of synapses in the brain, in this neuroinflammation in the brain, and it all comes down to this tiny cell.
There are quite a few characters in the story that you tell. One of my favorites is one who we meet early in the book, Kate Harrison. Who is she, and why does she show up so soon in your narrative?
So Katie shows up. I followed three women in the book who had tried many different things for their combination of neuropsychiatric and inflammatory or autoimmune disorders, different in each woman's case, because I thought that in telling this story, I was in the lab reporting like a fly on the wall and the work going on in all of the labs that I just talked about, but the human face of this story, the patients who have been trying the same old things year after year after year, what psychiatry has had on offer, which is, you know, talk therapy and psychiatric medications. And yet these patients were not really feeling that they were living real lives. So Katie Harrison, for instance, had tried every psychiatric medicine known to man over a decade or longer. She was doing everything she could with diet and exercise. And she was still pretty much housebound while raising two small children by her panic events, her depression, her mood issues. She even had to put a sign on her doorbell, "Don't ring the doorbell," because it was so jarring to her and could make her go into a state of panic. She had two beautiful young kids, not sons. A daughter and a son. And it was devastating to her that she could not live a normal life raising her children because of her psychiatric conditions. She also had some autoimmune issues, and autoimmune issues were rampant in her family, as were psychiatric disorders. And her grandmother had died of Alzheimer's. And so she had a lot of concerns. And I reached out, you know, to readers about whether or not they wanted to be interviewed for this book. And I heard from thousands of people. And I ended up following three of them for 2 years. And Katie's story really moved me because she was working so hard. She was doing everything her doctors told her, and then some. And nothing was moving the needle for her. And when she heard about this science, she was really upset in a way, because she felt, here I've been going to psychiatrists for 15 years. No one has ever mentioned to me, and of course, because they didn't know, that my body, just as my body, I can help my body by treating it as this very sensitive immune organ and change many of the things that I do in my life. I can also treat my brain as this very sensitive immune organ. And at the same time, a whole slew of fascinating treatments are emerging out of our new understanding of microglia. And she wanted to try those that, in her case, very well studied through many clinical trials already, approved by the FDA, and starting to come into clinicians' offices as treatments, non-invasive treatments for psychiatric disorders that could be used as part of the toolbox in addition to medications and therapy. Mm-hmm. And so she wanted to give it a go. And I wanted to follow her story and show how not the face of the patient, the face of human suffering by these disorders, the way in which psychiatry lags 50 years behind other fields of medicine, and how we're starting to see new tools emerge which have the potential to save patients' lives, give them back their lives. And Katie's was one such story.
So I freely disclose that I have had my own struggles with depression and anxiety. And one thing that I've noticed is that anxiety, let's say, is sort of its own perverse network. A minor setback in the morning leads to rumination in the afternoon, to mood fatalism in the evening, and then finally erupting into a full-blown panic attack at night. I almost want to say that this could be a way of understanding what happens with the over-pruning of these synapses that you write about. It seems to me that the fewer synapses does not result in something less than, if anything, the brain ends up being so much more the hyper-reactive thing that it always is. I mean, is that one way of making sense of the phenomenon?
So I think that, so a couple things I want to say about that. Yes. So this neurocircuitry that we can see, whether we can see on live now brain scans, live videos of any person's brain in real time, just by attaching little metal electrodes to the brain. Electrodes are just these little flat metal discs that go on the brain with a tiny little glue, a washable glue, and there are 19 of them, and a practitioner will put them on a patient's head and then make this movie of what's happening in the brain. And we can see in these movies of patients' brains, these live videos, that certain areas of the brain in certain disorders are lighting up too much, and because there's too much activity there, not synaptic activity, but neurons are firing in the wrong way, which is a kind of disruptive activity, or too little connectivity. Synapses have been overpruned by microglia. And so what you say is true. So there are practitioners and scientists working to correlate certain patterns in brain connectivity as seen on these videos and more, you know, intricately on PET scans and so on, to disorders and symptoms in the brain. Now, we're a long way from being able to correlate that perfectly.
Yeah.
But there are certainly patterns in loss of brain connectivity, for instance, in depression, in reward circuits of the brain that we can see very clearly associate with symptoms, and now also with levels of inflammation, of microglial activity being too high, and levels of inflammation being too high. So what I want to say about what you said is that this is not something that we want to leave listeners with the idea that this interplay is happening instant to instant in terms of microglia taking out brain synapses.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that gets set up by a series of things. We can look at everything from childhood trauma, which we know is associated with higher inflammation, more brain pruning, and more microglial activation, infections in the body, many different factors, chronic stressors in adult life, toxins, infections, all those things I've named now several times. So it's a combination effect, and it's over time. So all of these different influences, which can trigger microglia to go on overdrive and get overexcited and make them capable of this terrifying Jekyll and Hyde behavior, create something called neuroinflammation, which we think of like inflammation in the body as kind of a slow brew process, right? It brews over time and cumulatively, so that at some point we can reach a state of what researchers call runaway inflammation in the brain. What that really means is that microglia start getting activated to the degree that they just keep overactivating. And a little thing happens, and there's at this point in this state of runaway inflammation, they're just hair triggered now to do more quickly, more of the time. So even though this sounds really scary, because I just want to interject here, I think this, is all kind of terrifying, especially for a patient like me or a patient like you, it's also opened up this incredible world of possibilities for re-regulating these cells. You can't reboot a cell if you never knew what it did in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Now we know what it does. We know how it does it. It turns out that all of the different genes that are expressed in depression are expressed through microglia. It turns out that all the chemicals that we associate with mood disorders, with depression, with anxiety, we so long thought of disorders of the brain as disorders of, imbalances of brain chemicals, all of those are mediated through microglia. So microglia are like a light switch in the brain. Even electrically, the brain is an electrical organ. Even electrically, microglia help establish that direct current field in the brain, which then is the field from which our brain waves, which are associated with mood states and cognition, and if we're in a meditative state, we're using certain brain waves. If we're having a lot of cognitive issues, our gamma waves are impaired. So all of those rise out of that direct current field. And that's established by microglia. So they're like a light switch in the brain. And now that we know that they're at the heart of some of these epigenetic changes, these chemical changes, this over-pruning in the brain, and the electrical beat of our brain waves, it gives researchers all these different ways to come in now and reboot them and bring them back to homeostasis so that they do their good job. Remember, they have this good job, and it turns out their good job is not just to take away dead neurons. They're highly active as protective agents in the brain when we can get them back to their good state. They run around checking on neurons like good doctors, tapping on them, seeing, are you healthy here? Are you not healthy? In their good state, they'll surround neurons with neuroprotective factors, growth factors that help them make synaptic connections that actually help neurons create these protrusions so that they can connect with another neuron and fire and wire. So they build the brain, but they can also harm the brain. And as we understand what they do and how they do it, it is just a golden era in brain research of coming answers for how we can intervene in the process that you just talked about, where something happens in the morning, by the afternoon, two other things have happened, the mood state has crashed, the rumination is going, the intrusive thoughts are coming, and we can actually begin to intervene for those patients by helping the immune state of the brain and helping microglia to return to their good role.
Okay, so if I've come to appreciate anything from my time here at the Hogg Foundation, it is that a mind is a community project. We try to approach mental health in a holistic way, which isn't to say that we deny the value of medical intervention. In fact, it seems that one of the great potential benefits of this line of research is that it could lead to a renewed emphasis on early intervention and prevention, which we're all about.
Absolutely.
And we're fond of saying that one of the problems with our mental health system is that it's built for crisis, not prevention. Yet anything that's allowed to reach the level of crisis is going to be harder and more expensive to treat.
Right. So I agree with that 100%. And I write in The Angel and the Assassin quite a bit about coming medicine and how it's going to change that. And so let me just give you a couple of examples. Mm-hmm. Researchers are working now with some new tools. For instance, it turns out that microglia, because remember, they're completely connected to the body's immune system, drop factors when they're overactivated, which show up and are testable in the human bloodstream through a simple blood test. So looking at something like that is going to help researchers in situations, is already being used in situations like concussion. How activated are microglia? How neuroinflammatory is this situation in the brain? Let's look at some of these factors that they drop that we can test in the human bloodstream. But even more intricately, researchers are developing tests which will allow them to look at the state of microglia in the brain before microglia begin to do damage. So here's how they're doing this. They're using something called DropSeq technology, which allows them to attach a kind of barcode to microglia in their many different states. Okay, here's a microglia, it's so happy and it's, you know, doing what it should. It's protecting, repairing, and repopulating the brain's billions of neurons and trillions of synapses. And it has a certain barcode, like when you put your groceries on the belt at the grocery store. And oh, it's getting a little agitated, a little neuroinflammatory, getting ready to spit out some neuroinflammatory toxins. Here's that barcode. And here it is switching a little bit to become that little larger, bigger, spider-like, Pac-Man-like brain cell about to gobble up synapses. And here's that barcode. So they're looking at these different states of good microglia, activated microglia, toxic microglia. And with the hope, and I believe that this is coming, I believe we'll see it in the next 7 to 10 years, that they will be able to take a patient, let's say who's 12, and goes in for their 12-year-old checkup, which is around the time you run your first cholesterol test, just to make sure, you know, you're not missing something in a patient's cholesterol level at that early age, and run a simple blood test and go, okay, look at this, you know, everything is good. These cells are doing what they should do, kind of like taking a white blood cell count, right? A little different, but just a basic panel for microglial immune cell health. Or they might find, well, you know, these are looking like they're shifting into this active state that we don't really want to see. And, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, your beautiful daughter is also growing up in a family where there's a strong history of bipolar disorder. So we're actually going to take this kind of seriously. We want to look at the different things we can do. Here are some of the early interventions that we can start that are non-invasive, have no side effects, and things we're going to want to pay attention to. Imagine how that would change the field versus waiting until a patient is 19 and ends up in a crisis and begins to start taking and trying dozens of different drugs with many different side effects. It will change the game, and it's coming. Now, also in the book, I write about many different non-invasive tools coming in the toolbox. At the same time, there are some interesting pharmaceuticals coming, which are looking to be successful in early clinical trials by dampening down the activity of microglia in the same way we dampen down the activity of immune cells in the body in autoimmune and inflammatory disorders. To me, that should never be our first line of defense if we can be preventative, if we can get in there. Gamma light flicker therapy going on at Peak Hour Institute at MIT. I spent a lot of time there reporting on this unbelievable treatment in which Li Wei Cai, the director of Peak Hour, and her 50-people lab developed a piece of software engineering that allowed them and allows them, and this is moving quickly through human clinical trials now, is very promising, to create a little wand. And in fact, I was there with her in her office. This little wand has a couple of LED lights on it that create a 40 hertz pulse non-invasively outside of the brain and over the brain. Well, in the brain, in animal studies, this pulsing sends microglia a new message. Microglia stop. And remember, the brain's an electrical organ, and microglia set the direct current field, which then sets the activity of important brain waves that we associate with mood, behavior, and cognition. It resets microglial cells. They stop overpruning synapses. They stop spitting out inflammation, and they return to that good job of protecting and repairing and repopulating the brain's neurons and synapses. They stop that wildfire-like devastation. So under the right circumstances, we can coax microglia to being those angels of the brain, to becoming the brain's healers. And I think this holds the promise to one day prevent or even halt disease.
Donna, I can't thank you enough for agreeing to come on our podcast for a second time. The book is The Angel and the Assassin: The Tiny Brain Cell That Changed the Course of Medicine. We're thrilled for the book, and we hope that it makes a big splash with the wider public. Thank you so much.
Such a pleasure to be here, and thank you for your excellent questions, as always.
So, as I mentioned, this is Donna's second visit to our podcast. In episode 17, Childhood Disrupted, Donna and I talked about her previous book, Childhood Disrupted: How Your Biography Becomes Your Biology and How You Can Heal. In it, she summarizes the explosion of research on the connections between adverse childhood experiences and later physical illness, the crucial role that trauma plays in the mind-body connection, and what the experiences of survivors teaches us about withstanding trauma and triumphing over it. Here's an excerpt.
Something happens in childhood when kids are exposed to chronic stressors, and that is that the brain and the body and even the epigenetic expression of our DNA change in response to unpredictable stress. So what we see through this large body of research is that whatever the stressor is in childhood that's happening, when it is chronic and unpredictable, a child's brain goes on red alert. They never know when the next moment of high stress is coming, where they're going to have to be in fight or flight or freeze state. And that changes the way that the developing brain it responds to the world around it.
The episode is still available wherever our podcast is still available, and it is still a great conversation. I mentioned in my intro that we are giving away free copies of The Angel and the Assassin. In order to qualify, you must do one of two things. Either retweet our tweet about this episode, the one that you're listening to, or like or share the Facebook post about this episode. There is no deadline, but be warned that we only have 3 copies. So if you're interested, you need to act fast. Again, either retweet or like share the Facebook post about this episode and reference the book in some way, like the title, so that we know that you're interested in receiving a copy. It's first come, first serve. We've got 3 to give away. Do that, and I'll find a way to get in touch so that we can send you the book. We hope you enjoyed this episode. You can find related resources for this conversation in the episode description. Please leave us a review and subscribe to us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, or TuneIn. Thank you for joining us.